Welcome. Can everyone hear me? Does the mic sound fine?
Yeah.
Great. So I've been at Perkins for 12 years, and I've been in the Deafblind program for 8. Before I begin, I'm just curious who's in the audience. So is there anyone working with school-aged children? Great. Adult services? All right. How about TBIs? O&M? Nice. Speech pathologists? Great. OTs, social workers, any parents? Wonderful, great. I'm sorry. Or PTs. Nice. All right, did I get everyone? I didn't miss any glaring? No, okay. So communication is a really huge topic, and I'm going to try and squeeze it all into an hour. So I hope you get something out of the presentation. If you want to discuss more in depth, I'll be around after if there's any questions that start with, I have a student or my child does this, I'm happy to go into more depth with you after. And I'm going to volunteer Sharon as well. Okay, so what do you think of when you hear deafblind? What are the first thoughts in your head? You can shout them out, raise your hand. Sign language. What else? Helen Keller. Anything else? Usher syndrome. So we've got sign language and Helen Keller. I'm sorry, say it again.
Congenital rubella syndrome.
Rubella?
Very rare.
Very rare. Great. So normally when I introduce myself to someone for the first time, they say, oh, what do you do? And I say, I'm a teacher of the deafblind. I get very similar answers. So I get Helen Keller, Ann Sullivan, the miracle worker. Sign language, Braille, well, they can't hear, and they can't see, so they probably use a cane as well. And while all of this is true to an extent, it's really become kind of stigmatized as to what deafblindness actually means in today's population. So my goal for today is for everyone to start thinking about deafblindness in a different way and to figure out how they can support their students. So I'm a classroom teacher, so I say students, so I hope that's okay as far as who I'm referencing. It can really go from early intervention through all ages, the materials that we're going to be covering. So deafblindness defined, I really like this description because it was functional, but combined vision and hearing loss, which may challenge a person's ability to communicate, interact with others, access information, and move about safely. So start to think about that. I mean, again, we hear Helen Keller, we hear sign language, but what does deafblindness mean and how does it become isolating? And how can we facilitate communication with these individuals? So I wanted to do a deafblind simulation. Then I saw 90 people signed up for my session, so I had a panic attack. Hoped people wouldn't show up. But at the end of the day, I couldn't buy 180 or how many earplugs. So instead, I decided that I'm now a movie producer on top of being a teacher of the deafblind. So I made a little simulation. So I hope you enjoy it, just to kind of get a feel for what it may be like to be deafblind.
Grass to my left, gate in front of me, door over to the right. Oh, push to open. Okay. I heard the beep. That means the door's unlocked. Oh, I'm in the school building. I'm going to walk down this hallway. Recycling to my right. What's this sign? Oh, it's where the fire extinguisher is. Okay. Caution, wet floor. I better be careful. It's Maureen. She's smiling. She's happy to see me. Hi, Maureen.
So, let's be honest. During that first portion, who was sitting here tapping their foot, being like, come on, let's move on? One person's honest. Okay, great. But it really does show you, you miss a significant amount. And I mean, to have nobody facilitating any information in that first portion, I mean, what did you get? You got some colors, some light. Could anyone tell you were in a school? No, I didn't think so.
It was rather frightening to know what was going to happen.
Exactly. You don't know what's around you at any given time. I mean, I get up in the middle of the night in my familiar home, and I'm still terrified to go to the bathroom. So think about like living like that all the time. So going back to that functional definition, challenges one ability to communicate, interact with others, access information, and move around safely. So in that video example, can anyone share how any of these were lost? Exactly. So you didn't even know there was a person there who was signing hello, who was smiling. Somebody smiles at you and you know, okay, this person's happy to see me. I'm going to go interact with them. If you see somebody who's in an angry position and frowning, you're not going to go up to them, but you miss those cues. So that's communication, interacting with others. How about accessing information? Exactly, exactly. Wonderful.
Actually, I thought the person was probably standing still and people were walking towards them, but in reality, you were walking through.
Exactly. So everything, so, yeah. So if
you couldn't tell if there was a wall there or a door. The environment was not reliably accessible.
Exactly. And I think, you know, with skills and familiarity, you would build in those skills as far as to know what's around. But the point is, if you don't have someone accessing or helping you to access communication in your environment in an unfamiliar area and you're impacted by dual sensory impairment, you lose a significant amount of information. And that's just something I want people to be thinking about. So some of the most common causes of deafblindness, for a full list, you can visit the website below, but the top three, hereditary syndromes and disorders, so CHARGE syndrome, Down syndrome, Usher 1, prenatal congenital complications such as cytomegalovirus, hydrocephaly, microcephaly, and postnatal non-congenital complications such as asphyxia, severe head injury, or meningitis. So the, sorry, am I, can you guys see with me standing here? Is that okay? So the factors that contribute to the impact of deafblindness, the age of onset. So was it congenital? Were they born with it? Did they lose it later in life? What prerequisite skills did they have before they lost their vision and hearing? The degree and type of vision and hearing loss. Being from the vision field, you know there are varying degrees of vision loss. Is it field-related? Is it acuity? And hearing loss as well. Type of interventions provided and educational history. Did they have early intervention? What school setting were they in? What town were they from? What family supports did they have? And what adult supports are they getting? And then also the presence of additional disabilities. So what other factors are going on that really impacts them in their day-to-day lives? So I found this great video, actually. It was posted on Facebook. I thought it would be interesting as far as seeing a hearing loss simulation, because I think people think, oh, mild hearing loss, moderate hearing loss, they can still get a lot of information. And this video is a great example as to how people are impacted by varying types of hearing loss. And it's musical, so it's also entertaining. Let's see. Is that...
Try the world's best hearing aids.
How do I get that on the screen? It's a YouTube video? What, do I have to exit out? Let's see. I'm the least tech-savvy person you'll meet. Oh, there it is. Okay.
100% risk-free at ziphearing.com.
I know I'm young, could be a little bit wiser, but I've had my fair share of love, and I've seen enough of pain and hate, and fire and ice, to know the cold will suffice. Yes, to you, surprise, I'm educated, please don't underestimate me, if you can tolerate my opinion. Once in your life.
Let's see. Where was I?
Okay. You know, I couldn't help but think that there will be a fair number of people who are going to experience varying forms of hearing loss because they're listening to music too loud.
Yeah. Sorry, you guys can blame me in a few years then. Okay, so deafblindness today. So approximately 40,000 people in the U.S. are deafblind, 11,000 are youth. 90% of children who are identified as deafblind have additional physical, medical, and or cognitive disabilities. And most individuals who are deafblind have some useful vision and or hearing. So again, we're moving away from Helen Keller, and someone brought up rubella earlier. That was back in the 60s, a lot of the population that we were seeing. Now our students are not always able to access sign language. They're not always able to read Braille, so we have to think more critically and creatively in order to help facilitate communication. So today's children are tomorrow's adults, and with that being said, we have to be prepared to serve who we are serving now and who we're going to serve in the future. And it's cliche, but I had to add in a quote from Helen Keller, "Blindness separates people from things, deafness separates people from people." So how are we, within our professions, able to bridge that gap and link the people we serve with their environment and other individuals? So the way I broke down the rest of the presentation is into five sections. So form, how are we communicating? Function, why are we communicating? Content, what are we communicating about? Partners, who are we communicating with? And five, the physical environment. So where are we communicating? So we're going to start with form. So how? First and foremost, respectful interactions through touch. Individuals with combined vision and hearing loss require often on that tactile sense in order to get information. But really what we need to think about is that modulation of force. I mean, nothing's more invasive than someone just walking up to you, grabbing you by the arm, and bringing you where you need to go. I wouldn't like that, and I certainly wouldn't want to treat someone else that way. So respecting the individual space, approach slowly from the front. As you said in the simulation, you don't know if people are coming towards you or moving away from you. You don't want to tap someone from behind and require them to travel around just to find you. You want to gently touch or tap an individual's shoulder or arm. It's least invasive. And disclose what you're going to do with them before you do it. So if you're going to go somewhere, especially someone who's in a wheelchair, it's probably a lot easier to just go up, grab the wheelchair, and head off. But that level of disrespect is something we want to avoid. So, hi, it's me, it's Marguerite, and we're going off to speech class. Here we go. And then we talk about where we're going as we go. Is anyone totally opposed to having their neighbor touch them on the arm? No? So if you don't mind someone that's sitting next to you, if you just take turns, just close your eyes one at a time and just lightly tap the other person on their forearm. And I just want you to be aware of how little and light of a touch you need in order to gain attention. You can touch your own arm if you really don't want to touch somebody. That's fair. Huh? Yeah. So think about it. I mean, an incredibly light touch is enough to get attention, yes? So think about that with your students. A lot of our students are very defensive to touch. So you might even have to work up to something that light. You might have to work, start at a foot away and then slowly get closer and closer before you can even get that sense of touch. So think about it. Think about your own personal preferences and think about what your students may want. We recommend hand-under-hand. So hand-under-hand demonstration instruction is least intrusive. It provides spatial awareness, so where your hands are in space, and involves the individual in a task. So if I were the instructor and Sharon was a student, I would offer my hand to Sharon, and then I would demonstrate what we're doing. So I would say, here's the cup. And then she has the option to reach out and touch the cup. I'm not taking her hand and making her touch something. Right. So when you have that vision loss and that hearing loss, you're not really seeing what's going on. And so you want to make sure that the individual has control, they're able to participate to the amount that they want and at their own pace. And that's Sharon in the photo, my model. In thinking about the mode of communication, so individuals who are deafblind may use one mode for expressive and another for receptive. So me as a sighted and hearing individual, I use speech to express information, and I gain information primarily through someone speaking to me. As we mentioned earlier, 90% of individuals who are deafblind have additional physical cognitive disabilities. So they might not be able to expressively produce sign language if they don't have the hand strength or limited gross or fine motor skills. So really choosing the form depends on the social, physical, perceptual, and cognitive skills of the individual. And that's why I said earlier we need to start thinking critically about the population we're serving, because there are a variety of modes that may be accessible to them that we're not thinking about. So without getting into too much detail, here's a list of expressive and receptive means of communication. So receptive, sign language, tactile sign language, spoken language, print, braille, object cues, touch cues, pictures, photographs, gestures, tangible representations. Expressive, we have sign language, spoken language, written word, body movement, touching the object and or the person, demonstrating behavior, using gestures, vocalizations, tangible symbols, pictures, photographs, augmentative communication, and eye gaze. So by no means am I saying we all use all these all the time, but there's a wide variety that we need to find which are the most effective for the students. Individualization is key. I also want to say that this will be posted online at some point, so don't feel like you have to write everything down. It'll all be available. So one thing we talk about in Perkins and in general is the communication hierarchy, so how we develop abstract thought, abstract ability to communicate. So this is an example. It is by no means the rule. So for someone who's a visual learner, so has some functional vision, we're going from concrete on the left all the way to abstract. So concrete would be understanding what an actual object is and how it relates to an activity. So if I wanted to teach Sharon that the spoon meant that it's time to go eat, she would have to have meaningful interaction with that spoon, know that a spoon's a spoon, and that she's going to then eat with that spoon. Over time, maybe we want to make it more abstract. The next abstract level could be a photograph of a spoon. So that's taking away that tactual feeling. You're able to look at it, recognize it by its salient features, and say, okay, that's a spoon. I can communicate. I want to eat. That all makes sense so far? Okay. The next most abstract could be a picture or a Mayor Johnson symbol. So you would need to have the conceptual understanding that this gray blob on the picture represents a spoon, which then means eat. So you're getting further and further away from something that's concrete. Then we take a huge leap, but over to a written word. So before you can read and understand and communicate via written language, you need to have all this conceptual development. So think about that with your students, because where are they conceptually? And always be reevaluating what they're using, because the one wrong answer is, well, this is what they've been using, so we're going to keep doing that. No, constant reevaluation. It's okay to step back. We want to make sure they have a strong foundation of knowledge before we're moving on to more abstract forms of communication. So a similar hierarchy, this would be for somebody who has no functional vision or is using a tactile sense. So you would have the actual fork. Then it becomes more symbolic by maybe referencing a plastic fork. Becomes a partial object by breaking the fork in half. And something to note is that if a student is going to transition a mode, they should be active in helping break that item so that they know that the whole is now a part. And then we go all the way more abstract to written word in Braille. So again, it's huge leaps and examples, but just so you're thinking conceptually for the child. Okay, so in talking about object symbolism, what could this mean? Going to school, transportation, toy, go for a ride. Great.
What do you want to be when you grow up?
What do you want to be when you grow up? That's a new one. I've asked this question a number of times. I'm going to write that down. So you all said that because most of you, I believe everyone, has typical vision and typical hearing. So you're looking at this school bus and you're saying, oh, it's a school bus, and I have experiences getting a school bus and going to school. Therefore, I bet my student could understand that this also represents going to school. So when we're thinking about what we're giving to our students, we have to think about what's meaningful to the individual in that moment. So let's think of the experience of a student getting on the bus to go home. That was what I was going for, really, like you would want to... Oh, Siri interrupting me. But this is what a student might experience. So what could a good symbol be to help a student communicate that it's time to go home? The seatbelt. What are they actually feeling? What are they engaged with? The seatbelt piece. And if you're wondering, yes, they're available on Amazon. I checked because I thought someone might ask where to get a seatbelt. So really be creative. Think about... Yep. The buckles. It's excellent. So think about their experience. Put yourself in their shoes. Think about what they're getting from the environment, not putting your own adult bias on what you're seeing. So just a wide variety of examples as to different variety of communicational modes. So eat. If you're not eating by mouth, if you're eating by a G-tube, then referencing a spoon or a bowl or a plate is probably not appropriate. You would want to reference what they're using. So in that case, the G-tube. If they use a blue plate at lunch, then a blue plate could represent eat. Mayor Johnson, somebody eating. Eating a plate of food. Eating with a fork. Eating with a spoon. But really, it depends on the student's past experiences and really what's been embedded within their routine and everyday life. Okay, so talking about sign language. So sign language is, I mean, we use it all day, every day. Even if our students aren't producing it back to us, we use it because we believe in a visual mode of communication and higher language level exposure. So there's a wide variety in the types of sign language, but I decided just to talk about two briefly. American Sign Language, ASL. So it's a complex language with its own grammatical structure and uses signs made by moving the hands combined with facial expressions and postures of the body. Then there's Signed English, which is the use of the ASL sign vocabulary but presented in English word order. So I'm not saying one's better than the other, but I do think there have to be some things considered when you're picking a mode, and that's really their conceptual development. So for ASL, you have to be able to have the vision first and foremost to look at somebody and gain information from their face. You have to understand that a change of body position conveys more meaning, and because at that point the words aren't spelled out for you in ASL. So you have to infer a lot, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And then in signed English is a little more direct. So you would say verbatim every single thing that you're doing. So think of the conceptual level of the child and their visual access to information.
So if somebody's doing actual sign, is that signed English?
So I'm going to talk about tactile sign language. Tactile sign language is a mode of receiving information. It's not a language structure. So you can use ASL with tactile sign language. Signed English I'm trying to think. I'm not good in ASL, but it would be signed English, I'm going to eat breakfast.
Yeah.
Right. So whereas in ASL, it would be something like very short and simple, like, oh, and before I had some food. Whereas in signed English, it would be like, I ate breakfast this morning. I had a banana. I had an apple. So you're being very discreet. And that way it's very straight and to the point. You don't have to really infer much. So get to know your students. So tactile sign language. So I said it's a mode of receiving information. So again, it's hand under hand. So if I were signing to Sharon, Sharon again puts her hands on top of mine, and I would say, I'm going home. So she's feeling what I'm signing and getting the information from me. But when Sharon signs to me, she's just going to sign free air because I can see. You're going home? Okay, yeah, well, friendship's over. But again, so you have to be, the student has to be receptive to hand over hand. Again, tactile defensiveness can occur, and that would be something you'd have to build up to. So if a student really needs that hand under hand, make that a priority, work up to them tolerating your hands under theirs. In sign language, we want to think about also just access to that information and considering the vision loss. So with field loss, you have to think about where you're positioned from somebody in order to give them information. So something to think about when you're providing them with sign language. So I, again, went back into my producer mode and made a video. Let's see. Here we go. So just a short example, if you're very close up to someone and they have a field loss and you're signing these signs outside of their field of vision, they miss the whole message. So the first part you see eat, whereas she's actually signing, I like to eat eggs and toast in the morning. So consider knowing your student and knowing where the best place to be in order to provide them with information is important. And that goes not just with sign language, but with materials you're presenting, communication pictures, cards, objects, whatever. So in choosing a mode, team collaboration is absolutely key. We want the student involved, the educator, the SLP, the OT, audiologist, and the parent and guardian. It really has to be a team effort in order to set up a nice, solid communication system. Get to know the student, be a strong observer. If something's not working, then it's not working, and it's okay to reevaluate it. I think the best teachers will constantly reevaluate and make sure that the student is understanding the information they're giving and make the changes necessary. Don't just stick with it because it's been stuck out before. Use of the learning media assessment, communication matrix, our SLPs, I'm sure use that quite frequently. The functional vision assessment and the sign language assessment. It's the ADAM-LS. I just recently learned about this through Texas School for the Blind. They are making a really nice checklist where you can evaluate what accommodations someone may need in order to access sign language, the rate of sign language. It's an extremely useful tool, so I would recommend you looking into it. So when you're transitioning modes, so moving from one to another or introducing another one, you want to make slow and methodical changes with transdisciplinary assessments. So the whole team should really be involved. So the OT would say, well, the student doesn't have the hand strength to use this. Let's try this mode. And the SLP says, conceptually, they require this. So having all those assessments together and having a nice, solid team meeting would be really beneficial. Always checking, is the student demonstrating comprehension? So you don't want to move to more abstract forms of communication unless they're demonstrating comprehension at a lower level first before you're moving up. And the student should be part of the transition process. So as I mentioned earlier, the example with the fork, having them break the fork in half, having the experience that it became smaller. They could be participants in picking out their symbols. Whatever way they can be involved, they should be. So at the end of each section, I just listed some teaching strategies. We have a list that we reference in our teaching for deafblind best practice. So some things that would be embedded in the use of different modes would be having them embedded within a routine. Routine, consistency, and repeat experiences is key. Having conversations within motivating activities. So using those early modes in those motivating activities, because that's what they're going to want to talk about most. Having accessibility, knowing their visual, auditory, and motor needs. Having activities that have clear beginning, middle, and ends. Modeling higher levels of communication, positioning the students to access the materials, always working towards establishing joint attention, and being aware of how much you're prompting or over-prompting students in, as far as using their communication methods. Any questions so far? We're good? Great. Okay, so next, the function. So why are you communicating? So I only made one slide on this really because I think it becomes embedded within the next or the rest of the presentation. But just looking at the early basic functions of communication to the most complex. So we go from those early methods such as requesting, protesting, rejecting, accessing others, directing others, and making requests. Then we go to a more complex, which is greeting someone, offering someone something, confirming something, answering them, naming or labeling things, questioning, commenting, and replying. And then we go to the most complex, which is joking, lying, and persuading. So really, what can the student do and teach the function before you move on to something new? Make sure they really understand. Asking for help. So that could be requesting something. I guess, early on we often teach, we're asking for more, we're asking for finished or help. So I do put that into early basics, but more complex would be, okay, help, help with what? Help, I need this. So not going to dive too much into that, but just so you're aware, there's so many reasons to communicate. Okay, so content. What are we talking about? We always talk about something for some reason or another. Okay, so who can tell me about this? So no one knows what it is. Anyone want to guess? Fish eggs? Pomegranate? How's it look? Something nasty? Yeah. So, lemon? Anyone else? Medication? Okay. I know, I like the pondering. All right. We'll try another one. Can you tell me about this?
Apple.
An apple. Okay, what about apples? You eat them, they're shiny. What else? They're red? Or green or yellow? The crunch. Who likes them?
Horses,
horses too? Teachers like apples. Can you cook with apples?
Yes.
Can apples be in a pie? Can they be in a sauce? They grow on trees? Yes. Okay, so the point I want to make here is that you have to experience things before you can communicate effectively about them. That was an Australian finger lime. I just looked up exotic fruits and found it. It's a garnish, it tastes tart, and can be used in cooking. So we've never experienced an Australian finger lime, so why would we talk about it? You can't effectively tell me you like it, or that it's not poisonous, or where it's from. And meanwhile, we turned the apple on, and everyone here has had an experience with apples and can tell me something more in depth about it. Now, this is something we have to think about with our students. We cannot assume that they know things if they've never experienced it or participated in any activities that have to do with them. So that goes for people, objects, and activities. So here's another example. What's on the left?
Fork.
What's on the right? A comb. So you all knew that because of your experiences with them. Meanwhile, they're the same color. They're the same height. They have pretty much the same physical description. They have multiple prongs, and they're plastic. So if you didn't have any experience with them, then something like this probably would happen. I'm really proud of this animation, everybody, okay? But it's those meaningful experiences that we have with things that make them meaningful to us and that we can tell other people what they're for.
I've done that.
Have you done that? I'm sure it gets the job done in one way or another, but, at a dinner party, maybe avoid it. Right? Eating with a comb. That'll be my next presentation. Stay tuned. So when individuals have dual sensory impairment, so vision or hearing loss, incidental learning is often inaccessible. You need direct hands-on experience. So they can't just sit and watch something happen and get information from it. They have to feel it. They have to be a part of it. They have to be told what's going on. And those experiences should be repeat. As we mentioned earlier, those additional cognitive disabilities, repeat in meaningful context is extremely, extremely important. So the pictures I have up here is just an example of how a student can be engaged. So why should I assume the student knows what an apple is? We have to have experiences with it. So the student goes from selecting an apple. Does he want a red apple? Does he want a green apple? We talk about how it feels. He selects a green one. Then we take the apple cutter. He does it together. He cuts open the apple. He feels that now an apple is still an apple, even though it's in multiple pieces. He can feel that it has seeds in it, and then he can taste it. So those activities should, in some way or another, be transferred across all activities. So no activity is too small to be broken down into meaningful steps. So here are all the ways we might talk about an apple. When I asked what the apple was, people would say, oh, it's red, tastes good. But when you really think about it, there's a ton we could say. So at lunch today, Sally dropped her apple. It rolled on the floor. I don't like applesauce because I don't like apples. My favorite are the green apples. You'll really like this apple. Try it. It's juicy and sweet. And then my favorite, why did the apple pie cry? Because its peelings were hurt. Yeah, I didn't put too many jokes in this presentation because I didn't want to bomb too hard, but I'll throw that one in there. But it is cute. So you get the point. There is a wide variety of ways that we can talk about this one simple thing, this one piece of fruit. Now think of all the other activities we do in our day-to-day lives. I mean, how much can you say about this conference alone? Probably a good amount. So breaking it down for our students to access. So building content. So offering a variety of activities. Do not just assume disinterest. Encourage full and partial participation. Respect an individual's preferences. If they don't want to do something, don't make them. Give them the opportunity to participate and encourage them to try something new. If they don't want to participate, or even if they do, discuss what's available and what it's like. Share your own experiences. So you can tell them you went skiing over the weekend and how much fun you had and how you put your skis on and you took the ski lift up. Discuss it, because that's what we do with one another. We share our experiences and we tell stories. And always view behavior as communication. So if students are nonverbal and they're pulling away or shying away from something and they're doing it for a reason, don't just say they're being difficult or they're not in the mood, they're grumpy today. There's a reason they're acting that way. And we need to figure out why so that we can build on that communication and make it effective. So this is something when I say we're sharing experiences, for the most part, yes, we experience things in our day-to-day lives and that's how we communicate about them. But we can also communicate things that we haven't experienced. So for me personally, I've never experienced cage diving, but I can tell you that I don't like being confined in small spaces, I'm scared of sharks, and I communicate that I would not like to try this activity. So that's really where sharing information with students comes in handy. I mean, we really don't know what we don't know, right? So the more information, the better. Allowing students to make choices on things that they don't want to do is just as important as involving them in things that they do want to do. So again, just going back to teaching strategies, routine, motivating activities, thinking about that accessibility, clear beginning, middle, end to activities. That helps build anticipation and also alleviate a lot of anxieties. You know, things start and finish. When's that going to happen? Always be modeling higher levels of communication, positioning the students to access materials, and establishing joint attention. We want to make sure we're talking about the same topic in order to have effective communication. So partners, who are we communicating with? So communication partners must be equipped to communicate using the individual's required modes. So you must have familiarity with the modes and how to use it efficiently. You have to have a strong understanding of the individual's visual, auditory, and motor needs. So where are you presenting information? How are you presenting information? The partner must provide access to the environment, And there has to be collaboration between team members. Everyone has to be on the same page, especially when those early stages of development and communication, if one person is teaching one thing and another is teaching another, we're sending conflicting messages, and it's not really a smooth transition as far as moving towards more higher-level communication. So partners need to be available to bridge communication. I'm going to ask everyone to close their eyes and do not open them until I say. Okay, ready? No cheating. Okay, open them. That was 45 seconds of keeping your eyes closed with no information. So there's a few things we want to learn from this. The pause time for response that our students give, we have to provide latency for that. So even 10 seconds to an educator who's, you know, we're going, seems like a long time. So that's point number one. Point number two is, how easy is it for us to have a student and we sit them at the table and then we go help another student and we're gone for how long? 5 minutes? That was 45 seconds of absolutely zero information. And really, we have to be available to these students to facilitate conversation. I'm not saying you have to be with them all day, every day, but you have a conversation. You say, I'm going to go help Sally set up for lunch. Here's an activity for you to engage with while I go do this. Because it's lonely and it's isolating. So think about how many opportunities are there to have a conversation or interaction throughout the day and across how many people. I'm thinking back to the keynote speaker this morning. He said quality over quantity, and it's such a great point to make because you can say hi to someone all day long, but really to get down and to talk to somebody and get to know them and facilitate those conversations between other people is important. We want to develop respectful partnerships. How often does this happen? Where we have a student and then we're over and talking to the doctor and the doctor's addressing us and not acknowledging our student. How do we bring them into that conversation and help them be empowered to share what information they can? Even if they can share no information, hold their hand. Tell them that you are going to be telling the doctor about this specific amount of information or whatnot. Engage them. Do not leave them alone. Don't let them be isolated during those communication opportunities. So strong communication partners should encourage the individual to self-advocate, initiate conversations, teach them to tap someone, to wave, use an alternate means of attention seeking. They do not need to remain passive and wait. A lot of our students wait for someone to come to them. We need to teach them the appropriate ways to come up to somebody and initiate conversation. And then we also want to model and teach appropriate times for specific topics of conversation. So again, just going through those teaching strategies. So routine, again, I'm going to say it over and over and over. Clear and simple language, having clear expectations, modeling higher levels of communication, positioning of the staff and the client, joint attention, pause time for response, and again, behavior as communication. So lastly, the environment. So where are we communicating? So communication happens absolutely everywhere. You want to have conversations at home, at school, in a group home, in the community, with your family. Having access to a variety of environments allows for access to different topic areas. So encouraging students to have interactions with people at the grocery store, with the mailman, at the bank, at restaurants, ordering their own food, even if it's pointing to a picture and then the staff's helping clarify what they want. The more experiences in different environments, the better, because we don't want them just to learn skills in these isolated settings. They have to be generalized. You guys are gonna really think I like apples, but I just want to stay. I want to stay with the topic. So again, just increase generalization. So apples exist in the grocery store. They grow on trees. They're broken up. They're made into pie. They're available at home. They're not just in this one place, in this one setting, at this one time. So the environment allows for opportunities to model and teach appropriate topics and social rules across different settings with different people. So when do we shake hands with someone? When do we hug them? When do we talk about the bathroom? In the bathroom. And I think that's one thing we really need to be conscious about is what we're discussing in front of our students and modeling for them as well. There's certain topics I wouldn't want people to share about me in a public setting, and I definitely know that our students wouldn't want that for themselves. So to think about your own modeling of communication and what's appropriate in different places. And then dinner conversations. What do we talk about at dinner with groups? What do you talk about one-on-one with a good friend? There's many different layers to communication, and we have to think of them all. I thought this was hilarious. So the awkward elevator rides. So everyone's facing a different direction. So again, what do we talk about in the elevator? Letting our students know that there are other people present in the elevator. One of my pet peeves is when I see people come in with someone who's in a wheelchair, who's deafblind, and that person's the only one facing the back of the elevator. I mean, it's a silly thing, but it's a social norm, and we should be telling our students, oh, you know, when we go in the elevator, we turn around so we can exit easier, and this is where everyone else is turning. So just something to think about.
It
yes, it does. It does. And, you know, I never think that there's malintent by that. It's just something we don't think about and we take for granted. So I just think the more you see and the more you become aware, the more it becomes integrated in your own practice. So just some teaching strategies for facilitating communication within the environment. Again, that accessibility, having exposure in natural environments, so cooking in the kitchen, not just in the classroom. Naturalistic teaching and contrived, so sometimes there is time for those discrete learning, and then you take it to a natural environment and practice it there and vice versa. Modeling and establishing, again, joint attention. So in summary, there are many different forms of communication, symbolic and non-symbolic. There are many different functions as to why we communicate. The content of conversations is based on our experiences. We require reliable communication partners to communicate with, and conversations must occur across a wide variety of environments. So I'm happy to answer any questions, but thank you so much for coming. And for more information, the National Center on Deafblindness at nationaldb.org is a great resource for all topics deafblind. And Perkins eLearning has some nice webinars that are free. They're like 5 minutes, and that can help with materials and just different topics. So, yes? I mean, we haven't taught that in our population. I mean, again, that requires a significant amount of so many skills. So Tadoma method is when somebody puts their thumb over, the person who's deafblind will put their thumb over the speaker's mouth and then put their fingers on the vocal cords, and they can tell what you're saying by the movement of your lips and your vocalization. Yeah, the way the mouth's moving. So would I say it's completely off the table? No, but with the population that I'm working with, it's not readily used.
We haven't had a student who's used it in probably, I don't know, 10 or 15 years. We've had, in recent history, we have, by recent, that's what I mean, you know, maybe 10 years ago he graduated, but you have to have a certain cognitive ability to be able to understand that. It's like a tactile form of speech reading. Of lip reading.
Yep.
That's really.
Any other questions? Great. All right, thanks.